Okay, I know you're hungry and we just heard some fabulous lectures. You want to think about them, but I think one of the greatest play spaces for thinking about curiosity is the universe, of course. People have been curious about the universe from as long as humans have looked up into the sky, so I think that's a great place to start. And we're going to look at a few things that I think are inspire curiosity about the universe and also make us realize that the universe itself is curious. You see, in the dictionary, the word curious has more than one meaning, so there's kind of a play on this in my title because I believe that the universe actually inspires curiosity and that the universe itself is curious, the meaning of the second meaning of the word meaning something that's unusual or unique. So let's begin with just a few hopefully mind-bogglingly inspirational images that we're getting from telescopes these days. This is a beautiful picture of a star cluster forming out of interstellar gas. And so in this image, you can see this beautiful nebula of gas and dust. And in the center and toward the bottom, you see a cluster of massive stars that have recently coalesced out of that gas. We now know that the universe is a very active place, lots of things going on. Our galaxy has many of these interstellar clouds where new stars are continuing to coalesce and form. They are very important factories, stars are, for producing heavier elements. I'll get to more of that in a moment, but it's also an object of beauty when we can view them with telescopes that can differentiate star from star and see the beauty and wonder of the gas and nebulae out of which stars form. Well, how are we studying the universe? Curiosity has driven people to develop technologies for mainly the sole purpose of investigation, of curious investigation with no practical purpose. So it might have been condemned by some of these voices we just heard about in the past, but curiosity-driven technology development has enabled us to study the heavens in ways we've never been able to before. Astronomers use different kinds of telescopes as tools, and we need them all. I like to describe the way astronomers use telescopes as similar to the way an orchestra conductor would use different types of instruments and musicians all working together to give a fuller sense of the piece of music being performed. In astronomy, we use optical telescopes, infrared telescopes, X-ray telescopes, radio telescopes, many different kinds of telescopes to perceive different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. We also use telescopes on the ground and some up in space because they have different capabilities as well. This image shows you a representative collection of telescopes. On the lower left are the Keck telescopes, which are on the ground but situated on a high mountain where the clouds, as you can see, are beneath. Clouds in the atmosphere can block light from space coming to our telescopes or can blur the images a bit. So we like to get telescopes as high as we can or in the case of radio telescopes, as far away from interference and in the driest place that we can. The lower right image there is a collection of radio telescopes in South America that are being used now to study much of that interstellar gas and dust where stars are forming. And at the top there, you see an example of a space telescope. There are quite a few telescopes in space now, but this is the most famous one, the Hubble Space Telescope. It's orbiting the Earth that you can see below there. It's whizzing around the Earth about every 90 minutes. And it's up there, not because it gets the telescope much closer to the kinds of things we want to look at, but because it's above the clouds and we get much sharper images. The astronauts have helped us with that Hubble telescope to keep it in tip-top shape. So we've been very pleased over the 27 years of the Hubble Space Telescope mission that we've been able to send astronauts on the space shuttle up to visit the Hubble five times, in fact, since it was launched to repair things or put in new and improved science cameras and instruments, keeping that observatory in tip-top shape. And so right now that telescope is working very, very well. In fact, we're getting better science from the Hubble now than we ever have in all of its 27 years up to now. So the observatory is in good shape. And even though the space shuttle program is not operating anymore as NASA develops a newer future space vehicle, we think the Hubble telescope will continue to work well even without servicing for some years into the 2020s, overlapping with its successor, which is called the Webb Space Telescope. So that's all good news. These are our astronaut heroes that went up for the last servicing mission a few years ago and did a terrific job. It took years of preparation, building new instruments and training the astronauts and so forth to get them ready to do this mission. But they did a superb job. They went up on the space shuttle. The space shuttle pulled the Hubble into the cargo bay and allowed the astronauts in their spacesuits to come out of their pressurized cabin and go out and do 5 days worth of servicing on the telescope, repairing things and putting in new instruments. It was not all trivial at all, and there were some near crisis moments in terms of bolts that wouldn't come loose, things like that. But I can tell you that there was prayer in the control room going on, at least from one person. Okay. But God was gracious, and the mission did all work out well. Everything we wanted them to do, they did well. And so now we have this terrific suite of science instruments on the Hubble telescope giving us views like this, which we also correlate with imagery from other telescopes. So where does Curiosity fit into this? Well, everywhere. I mean, that's what drives astronomy. But I like this picture here because this is an image taken by one of the astronauts on this last servicing mission from the space shuttle from inside. And if you look carefully out the window, you can see the Hubble telescope there, which is docked in the bay or nearby the space shuttle at that point. But this astronaut, John Grunsfeld, took with him a replica of Galileo's telescope. So that is Galileo's instrument four centuries ago that he used to make the first recorded observations of objects in space using a telescope. So he used this device, which had been used in other ways before him, but to actually look up into the heavens and record what he was seeing, and found out, for example, that Jupiter has these little bits of light right next to it that move around back and forth, and now we know those are the moons of Jupiter. You can replicate Galileo's experiment yourself by just taking a good pair of binoculars out on, if you can find a dark night, a clear dark night somewhere, point the binoculars up to Jupiter and look carefully, and you'll see these tiny little white lights in a plane right next to Jupiter. And every night they move around a little bit, so you can tell that they're not stagnant. John Grunsfeld, the astronaut, said that when he looked through this replica of Galileo's telescope, he was terribly unimpressed by its quality, and he was surprised Galileo saw anything at all. And yet it is that curiosity that is I think, exemplary of the human drive for curiosity. And the improvement in telescopes everywhere, all these centuries from Galileo's telescope to world-class instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope, has been largely driven, I think, by curiosity to know not just what's out there, but how do we fit in? How do we fit into this universe? Who are we, and what is our significance? With the telescope, with good telescopes, we're able to get very good resolution, which means we can differentiate star from star, even in crowded fields. This is the core of a cluster of galaxies. It was taken as a calibration image with the newest camera on the Hubble telescope. But it's such a beautiful image that we now show it off. So you can see, this camera can see everything from blue to red and a little bit beyond blue into the ultraviolet and a little bit beyond red into the infrared. So you see this tremendous range of color that shows up in this cluster of stars. Globular clusters are known to be very, very dense. And here you can see just absolute majesty. I look at this as kind of a collection of gemstones. Now, astronomers go on and sort out stars like this. When you can differentiate star from star, it allows you to do spectroscopic analysis of individual stars, so you can start teasing out which ones are older, which ones are hotter, which ones are of different compositions. Turns out in globular clusters, most stars are quite old. They're almost as old as the galaxy itself. It's helpful to see this in context, so we're going to see if this works. We're going to look at a bigger field of view. So the Hubble telescope only sees a small field of view in the sky. If you want to see a bigger field of view, you have to look at from a perspective of a different telescope. So this is an image looking toward the plane of our galaxy taken with a telescope on the ground that has a wider field of view. And you can see there the dust and many stars along the plane of our galaxy and lots of stars around it and some bright objects. Some of them are bright stars and some of them are actually dense clusters of stars. I'm going to see if this is going to let us zoom in with my clicker. If not, I'm going to have to ask Pete behind us to help. But what I'm hoping we can do is zoom in from this wide field image and so we can see the context of a globular cluster. Here we go. So that's the Centaurus constellation. We're zooming in now on this object, which now we can see is actually a cluster of stars. And we're going to transition into the Hubble Space Telescope image, which gives us all the detail. All right. So curiosity can drive us to build technologies which then enable us to see things in context that we wouldn't have been able to see before. Some people like to do that again. You want to do that again? All right, let's do that again. I don't like the violent constellation, but there we go. Zooming in, what would have been thought to astronomers for centuries before was just a star. It turns out not to be a star. It turns out to be an entire cluster. And then with Hubble, we can dive in and actually differentiate star from star. So curiosity drives us to learn more and to find out more. With telescopes, we're seeing great beauty, nebulae, where stars are still being formed, and the newly formed massive stars actually send out so much energy that they can ionize the surrounding gas. We get these beautiful nebulae. This is the Orion Nebula. This is the Monkey Head Nebula, but you're going to be challenged to see a monkey's head in there. The Horsehead Nebula, this is an infrared image which shows you some of the more ethereal, dusty views around this nebula. Some of you may have even seen this with a good telescope of your own. To me, it looks more like a dragon than a horse. But just a tremendous beauty enabled by curiosity, I think, driving improvements in telescopes to enable us to look out and see more. We're even seeing fantastic beauty and activity in old stars. So this is an older star releasing its outer atmosphere, which is a common phase of aging stars. As they begin to run out of their inner hydrogen fuel, they become unstable, and as they go through their sort of death throes, if you will call it, they release their outer atmosphere, sometimes in spectacular ways. This bipolar outflow from an old star is not only energetic, but it's beautiful, I think. And so this one has been given a name, and I would ask you what you think its name is. What do you think this is called? Kissing fish? That's a good, there's no right answer, but what's the most common name for this nebula? A butterfly, right. So this is called the Butterfly Nebula, right. Kissing, did somebody really say kissing fish? Okay, I like that. The Kissing Fish Nebula, okay. That's good. I mean, it's like I say, no one but God owns the universe, so, you know, you can name your own constellations if you want, and you can name your own nebulae if you want, so we'll call this the Kissing Fish Nebula from now on. I like that. Kids would like that better, too. All right. More massive stars end their prime of their life in even more spectacular ways. As they become unstable, they actually end up exploding. So this is the debris of a supernova explosion from 1,000 years ago that, shall I say, curious sky watchers from 1,000 years ago actually saw, mainly from China. They recorded this star brightening up. And the debris is still moving out in this remnant, the supernova remnant. Buried in here somewhere is a neutron star, the leftover very dense remains from the original star. And the different colors here showing up are representing the different elements that have actually been forged inside that star. So it turns out that while most of the interstellar gas is hydrogen, and stars therefore are mostly made of hydrogen, the fusion process in the core that turns hydrogen to helium and releases light from a star, that process also produces other heavier elements, carbon and iron and nickel, so forth, oxygen. And then these are released when the star explodes. It actually enriches the surrounding interstellar medium, and then subsequent generations of stars forming out of this interstellar gas, still mostly hydrogen, but are enriched with these heavier elements. And those subsequent stars, as they have heavier elements in their environment, can actually form dusty disks. As they form, and out of those dusty disks, we now know planets can form. So stars, I call God's factories. They're wonderfully spectacular ways of producing heavier elements, but you need several generations of stars to enrich the interstellar medium to the point of being able to form stars that can harbor planets. And planets are interesting in their own right. So here's a beautiful image of Jupiter taken with the Hubble telescope. You can see all its majestic atmospheric bands, and we've been able to watch it over decades now and see that these planets actually change their atmospheric patterns. Even that big red spot has changed over time. So the universe does drive us to curiosity. What's out there? One of the main questions, curiosity-driven questions that has been around for millennia and is taking a new fervor again now, is the question, could there be other planets, particularly planets like Earth in the universe, and is there Earth-like situations where there could be life? Big question, good question, not a new question. People have been wondering if there's life out there and curious about it for, as I say, for as long as humans have looked up in the sky. Greek philosophers thought about it. Here's Epicurus saying that there are infinite worlds, both like and unlike this world of ours. Now, of course, he's using the word world a little different than we would use it now. But he's saying we must believe that in all worlds there are living creatures and planets and other things we see in this world. So these imaginative Greeks were already wondering, could there be other worlds, in whatever way they were using that word way back then. And when I look at this famous painting here, a lot of us wonder, you know, all these guys had to do was sit around and talk and think and converse. Who was washing their clothes and who was minding the children, you know? Fast forward some generations and you find out that medieval scholars were also contemplating activity on other worlds. Giordano Bruno said that there are countless suns and countless earths all rotating around their suns in exactly the same way as the seven planets of our system that they knew then. The countless worlds in the universe are no worse and no less inhabited than our Earth. Pretty speculative with no data, right? But quite imaginative. In fact, he was pretty outspoken, as you know, and that didn't do him well in the end. He was burned at the stake, but not so much for this statement. He did some other things that bothered people. But nevertheless, he's revered now. There's his statue in Rome. There's a rose there. People come and pay homage to Bruno even now. So he's seen as a person, a forward-thinking person, perhaps even a curiosity-driven person. And now, centuries later, we're curious again because our technology is enabling us to truly investigate and detect planets around other stars. This is an artist's conception of a very real system that was detected with the Kepler Space Telescope a few years ago, a star system with six planets that are tightly in tight, close orbits around that parent star. It was detected not by taking a nice picture like this, but by looking at the star and seeing how it dimmed periodically when planets orbit around between the star and our vantage point on Earth. These transiting planets create a dimming effect as they go in front, and we can very carefully discern how big the planet must be that's causing that, or even if there are multiple planets. It's quite an art now. We've now, through various techniques like this and others, detected thousands of planets outside our own solar system. And we're even detecting dusty disks made of that enriched material I told you about, forming around stars as the stars themselves form. Here's an example of a star, a very young adolescent star forming, called HL Tau. And you can't even see the star. This is an image taken with the radio observatory in the lower right. This is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in South America. And it's attuned to emission from hot dust. So what it's detecting is not the star buried in the middle there, but this big dusty disk around the star, the forming star, where we believe planets actually form along with stars now. And you see the ring structure there. It now appears that these disks can have ring structures. And those, at least in our own solar system, ring structures are indicative of orbiting bodies. So the rings around Saturn are shaped because of moons around Saturn. Well, in this case, the rings around HL Tau may be indicative of planets forming in those disks. So there's a lot of further study going on. Well, could there be life on these planets? Well, again, this discussion has been going on for much longer than it has any right to be going on. So apparently there were theologians debating this issue in early Christianity, in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries. And these are nice collections. If you're interested in that, you can look at these anthologies or these collections by Michael Crow about the extraterrestrial life debate from antiquity, and then in more recent years as well. And I really think these are wonderful collections. I don't have time to go into that now, but just to tell you that people were curious about this even before they had observations, and they went on into the curiosity of, well, what would this mean theologically? What would it mean if there were intelligent life beings on other planets? Would Christ have to visit all of those planets in different forms? What would that mean for salvation? People were thinking about this both just philosophically and theologically from a long time ago. Nowadays, we're curious to know whether other planets that we're actually detecting could support life. So we're developing techniques. Since we can't actually visit these other planets, they're too far away, we have to do everything by remote sensing. We're developing techniques that could see things in the atmosphere indicative of life, just as when we look back at planet Earth, we see activity or compositions in our own atmosphere that indicate life. So we would look for things like ozone, which, or evidence of oxygen, which in our own atmosphere is replenished by the plant life on Earth. We'd look for evidence for liquid water, which is not proof of life, but it's actually something that's necessary for life, at least on planet Earth. We would look for reflected light that's indicative of life and plants as we see on planet Earth. Even things like methane, which is abundant in our atmosphere, is largely produced by livestock. So we could look for a bovine planet somewhere else where there's a lot of methane in the atmosphere. I think you all say methane, don't you? Something like that. I'm trying. All right. And you have to rule out other explanations for these things. So this is a hot science of astrobiology, I think, driven by modern curiosity. And of course, there's been theological reflection on what this would mean, not only in ancient times, but even C.S. Lewis in his science fiction trilogy was speculating about the spiritual state of possible life elsewhere in his imagination. So you can read those and kind of follow what his thinking would be. We have other things that we're curious about. We now know that these beautiful nebulae and stars are actually components of what we call galaxies. Galaxies are gravitationally bound collections of gas and dust and stars. Here's an example, spiral galaxy. There's so many stars in the core of this galaxy that all the light just kind of blends together in the core there. And you can see some other galaxies in the background there if you look carefully. This is a beautiful image that I just love this as an example spiral galaxy. We think our own spiral Milky Way looks something like this with our sun allowing one of those spiral arms. Here's an artist's conception of our own Milky Way. We can't get all the way out of it to take a nice picture, but from looking around on the inside, we're pretty sure this is what it looks like. And you can see our solar system there in the kind of lower left quadrant. Our sun and all of our planets would be right there, but there are many, many other stars and star-forming systems near us. And as we look toward the galactic center, we see lots and lots of stars blended together. We now know, however, for the last century, basically, that our galaxy is not the only one. Looking up with these curiosity-driven telescopes, astronomers discovered and debated whether or not these little nebulous objects they were seeing were actually island universes, as they call them, what we now call other galaxies. And of course, now we know there are plenty of other galaxies. This is the famous Hubble Ultra Deep Field, where a tiny drinking straw area of the sky was observed, and light was collected, again, just out of curiosity to find out what you would see, if anything, if you pointed the telescope, this would be the Hubble telescope, in a direction of the sky where there weren't any nearby stars, and it was kind of out of the plane of the galaxy, and just collected light for several days, picked up the faintest light you could see. Would you see anything? There was some debate about it. And this is what came out of that, which is thousands upon thousands of galaxies. Every little blip of light in this image is a galaxy, and galaxies, as I said, contain billions of stars. You can see different types of galaxies in this image, spiral galaxies, elliptical galaxies. There's a couple of foreground stars you can visit, you can see there that are from our own galaxy, but everything else are other galaxies. Just mind-boggling. I mean, imagine this extrapolated over the whole sky. This is the universe that we live in. That in itself is mind-boggling, but then think the third dimension. These galaxies are all at different distances, right? So it's taken a different amount of time for the light to get to us from these various galaxies. And so one of the most difficult enterprises for astronomers is to try to gauge the distance to different galaxies. But that's being done. And then you can compare then the composition and the morphology of galaxies from different distances and use that as a time machine to see if galaxies have changed at all over time. This type of enterprise shocks everyone. Even the Huffington Post became reverent there for a moment when this latest image came out. They said it was holy Hubble. Here's a graphic discussing what I just described, which is how telescopes, kind of going from the top to the bottom there, representing how telescopes or cameras in those telescopes have improved over recent years. That's enabled us to see fainter and fainter galaxies in images like this ultra-deep field. Fainter things tend to translate to more distant galaxies, so that's what those arrows are showing, that as telescopes get better, we can see farther out into space, seeing more distant galaxies. And of course, that translates into seeing farther back in time because it's taken longer for the light to get to us from those distant galaxies. So you can see down there, you know, 2010 and on into the present and the future, we're seeing back to within the first few hundred million years of the known of the universe. The time scale on the bottom sort of goes from right to left, with the Big Bang, the beginning of our universe, off the chart to the right, and then moving to the left to our present time. It's not a linear scale, but that time frame, we believe, is about 13.8 billion years total from various lines of evidence. And we're now seeing baby galaxies start to coalesce from within the first 0.8 of the 13.8 billion year history of the universe. The next Webb Space Telescope should see even a little closer to the beginning of time. So we're seeing the first gas forming the first galaxies, and then we can sample galaxies at different epochs of time, even close to our own time and in our own Milky Way, and see how galaxies have changed. And in fact, they have changed. So here we go, what I would use the other word definition of the word curious, a very surprising and unusual or unique feature of the universe that we're now able to tease out, which is that galaxies have changed over time. So pulled out of this deep field and put into these ordered circles are galaxies at different distances. So we're seeing them from different epochs of time. The ones on the left are galaxies closer to us in our epoch of time. You see they're big and well-formed. As you move through the circles to the left, you're looking at more distant galaxies, and you can see that they are smaller. They're less well-formed. The earliest galaxies on the right are tiny things. They're not as massive. What's happened over time is that galaxies merge together. They grow in mass, and they also have generations of stars coming and going and enriching the interstellar gas with heavier and heavier elements so that you can have planets forming around stars in galaxies that are as old as ours, and you didn't have those elements available in the earlier epochs of time, in the earlier galaxies. We can see the whole universe through a time machine now of astronomy. And the other curious part of the universe that we've noticed is the fine-tuning, or the apparent fine-tuning. It appears that if the forces in the universe, the fundamental constants that drive all the physics of the universe, were slightly different, we wouldn't have the ability to form the stars and the planets. I don't have time to go into that now, but here's a nice chart that kind of summarizes the interesting Goldilocks zone for where our universe seems to sit. If the value in this case on this chart of the electromagnetic force or the strong nuclear force were even slightly different than what it is, we wouldn't have hydrogen, we wouldn't have carbon and heavier elements or the chemical reactions that we need for stability, for stars to form, for planets to form, and for life to evolve. Now, I think fine-tuning arguments are really interesting, but I don't think they're actually critical, in my view, for an apologetic. I was a Christian long before I ever heard of fine-tuning. So it's an interesting observation, but not necessarily a crux of faith. But nevertheless, we see these interesting things. We see that the universe has developed over time. It continues to mature and change with the production of stars, heavier elements, and planets, providing conditions needed for life to thrive on at least one planet, maybe on many others. Does that imply purpose for the universe? That's now moving from the science to the philosophical question and the curiosity that's driven by a quest for meaning. So some would infer philosophically from looking at this progression of the universe, and some from the apparent fine-tuning, that it does imply purpose, that there is a reason for it all, but that's a philosophical question. The Templeton Foundation asked this collection of scholars whether there's a purpose for the universe, and these esteemed people, some scientists, some philosophers, some theologians, some science popularizers, they all had different responses, and I encourage you to look up on the Templeton website. You have to search around a little for it, but these short answers are accompanied by a longer essay that each one of them wrote. Some scientists there would said no. I mean, that's a pointless question. We now address everything through science. There's no purpose in asking the question. Owen Gingrich on the right there, a professor of astronomy and the history of science at Harvard, said, "Well, absolutely yes. How can you look at this progressive universe and not see purpose in it?" And Neil deGrasse Tyson down at the bottom says, well, it depends on who you ask. You know, if you ask the bacteria in your gut, they would say the purpose of the universe is to produce humans that will produce a nice gut home for us to live in. So, you know, these are different philosophical takes, and I show this to say that this is not really a science question, but it is a philosophically driven question, driven by curiosity, I think, that we as humans have. And Freeman Dyson said it wouldn't be surprising if it turned out that the origin and destiny of the energy in the universe cannot be completely understood in isolation from the phenomena of life and consciousness, and that the design of the inanimate universe may not be as detached from the potentialities of life and intelligence as scientists of the 20th century, his century, have tended to suppose. So in fact, maybe the development of the universe and conscious life is a purposeful intertwining that we can see played out in our scientific observations. I give you a little preview. Dennis Alexander here in the room has written a wonderful book on Is There Purpose in Biology? The Cost of Existence and the God of Love. And I think he's done a lot of thinking about purpose in what we can see through science. This book is out in a few months, I'm told, so look forward to that book. There's also a curiosity, as I close up here, about significance. We are curious to know, as we learn more and more about the universe, are we significant? What does that mean? That's not really a scientific question, again. Carl Sagan, the great astronomer who inspired me in many ways to go into astronomy, but he seemed to feel that we are not significant as we learn more about the universe. Lots of people would agree. He said, "Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of the universe." Do you ever feel that way when you wake up in the morning? But that's a philosophical choice. You know, I think I view significance, and the Bible views significance in a different way. The Bible would agree that our lifespans are short. We are like dust. Several times we're reminded of our insignificance in that sense. And then we're told we have great significance in another way, that God has endowed us with great significance. Here's a curious psalmist who wrote Psalm 8. Probably the shepherd looking up at the sky, and he said, "O Lord, our sovereign, how majestic is your name in all the earth. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you've established," here's his sense of insignificance, "what are mortal human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them, for us?" But then he went on, he said, "And yet you've made them, us, a little lower than God, and crowned them with glory and honor. You've given them dominion over the works of your hands, and you've put all things under their feet." He realized that God had given us a significance, and that included dominion. And he was already looking at things that they can't touch. So that dominion, to me, includes science, study of things that we can't manipulate. So I would agree, actually, with the psalmist that we are significant because God has endowed us in part with curiosity and the ability to learn about the world around us. And I would go even farther and say that the Gospels have told us something astounding, that this universe of which we are so curious was actually created through a living being. The opening verses of the Gospel of John say that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and through him all things were made. In him came all life. This is a person, not physics, at the ultimate end of our penultimate curiosity is the person, and that the Word became flesh, body made of star stuff, and dwelt among us. This to me is astounding. I believe that Jesus Christ is the end result of our penultimate curiosity. Becoming incarnate on planet Earth. All right, I must close, but we respond to this by giving praise. We feel humility and awe. I believe a proper response to all this is caring for our planet and all of its inhabitants, including other humans, but other animals as well, and to continue exploring. There's lots to explore. I don't have time to go into it, but we were curious about what is dark matter, what's dark energy, is there life beyond Earth? We now know the universe is accelerating, but we don't know what's causing this dark energy that's pushing the universe apart. Nobel Prize awarded for discovering this, but we still don't know why. If you're paying attention, you'll notice that gravitational waves were finally first detected recently, a couple of years ago, by two merging black holes sent out a signal, not radiation, but of changes in space itself, space-time. And just a few days ago, a signal from neutron stars that was detected not only in gravitational waves, but in electromagnetic radiation as well. So lots of things to still learn about the heavens. We're even seeing water vapor plumes being spewed out of a Jupiter's moon, Europa. So we might even have a way to test for life there soon. I'm speeding through a lot of this. You can be inspired by the universe. I think our curiosity brings us not only to more knowledge, but to inspiration as well. Like the psalmist, Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, not through audible words, and yet through some message that goes into all the earth." I gave this talk to an artist, and she thought the universe looked like, the galaxies looked like dancing, and so she was inspired to draw this image of a spiral galaxy dancing. This is a woman from Iran. Her name is Mahshid Fati, and I thought it was a beautiful piece of artwork. An astrophysicist from over here at Cambridge has this image over his desk that he shared with me from a mausoleum in Ravenna, Italy. This image on the top dome of the mausoleum was put there 1,700 years ago. Any navigator would recognize the circular patterns of stars are what you see when you look at the North Star, and as the Earth rotates night to night, or through the night, you see a pattern of the stars appearing to rotate around it. And yet in the center of this image is not the North Star, but a cross, because whoever put this together was trying to remind the navigators and travelers coming through the city to be inspired by the heavens to keep Christ at the center of their life. And my astrophysicist friend was inspired in the same way. He kept this image over his desk to remind him to navigate his life around Jesus Christ. My fellow astrophysicist Gladys actually inspires school children in orphanages by going over there and telling them about space. These kids have enough food and drink and school and clothing, thankfully, but what they're inspired by is when she goes over as a missionary and tells them about what we're learning in astronomy, and they're so excited, they all tell her they want to be astronauts. Okay. Let me just tell you that if you're interested in the interface of science and Christian faith, here's some other resources. I can show you these later, but I did want to mention the American Scientific Affiliation, which is a kind of sister organization to CIS, and we have a lot of interesting resources on our website, www.asa3.org. And also, you can come to our meetings, too, in the U.S. usually, but they're wonderful gatherings. We'd love to have you. We live in an incredible, inspiring, and fruitful universe that we're discovering through curiosity. This Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion program that I direct for a science society developed a series of very short videos, and I think as we go to lunch, I probably won't take any questions if that's okay because we're out of time, but I would like you as you go to lunch to see this video that we created for seminaries, but really they're good for anyone on curiosity and awe. So if you can cue that up and play this, we'll look at this right before we go to lunch, and hopefully this will inspire you for the rest of the day as how different scientists actually glean a sense of awe and inspiration from their curiosity-driven science.
The instant that one realizes that you're having a genuinely new thought is essentially indescribable. I'm sure that this is something similar to what people describe as a muse. It seems unworldly.
I had a little telescope. I'd take up country, and everybody in the village would come out, and they'd look through the telescope and see the craters on the moon or the rings of Saturn, and they'd go ooh and ah, just like my family and friends back in Michigan do. And it finally hit me. This is what makes us human. This ability to look at the sky with wonder.
When when I look through a microscope, I can't help but be struck with a sense of awe and wonder about what I'm looking at. And I can't help but reflect on the larger questions of life.
The human spirit does gain a lift from pure curiosity, trying to understand who we are and where we fit into the larger scheme of things.
Because if we didn't have that sense of awe, if we didn't have that sense of curiosity, we wouldn't start down this road in the first place. It's hard to do world-class science.
When you look into something, you almost always get a surprise, and then that surprise leads you into new pathways.
Are there failures? Absolutely. When you don't have very firm grounds, you're really searching for a needle in a haystack. I've collected a lot of hay before I found that needle.
It sure is fun to play in this space and to make new discoveries and hopefully make contributions that move us forward.
Science loves problems. Any fool can find the solution. Takes a genius to find the question.
We live in a world loaded with questions and puzzles. If you know how to look, you can begin to see connections among humans and other species, and between humans, other species, and the planet itself. And when you see those connections, it's hard not to be in awe.
That kinship that human beings share with all other creatures on Earth is a very, very powerful thing and helps us to understand the continuities and to place into context our uniqueness.
So we get into those philosophical questions of what is life? And within that context, what is it to be human?
There's this incredible universe that surrounds the Earth for us to go and explore, and that we as humans have to pick up that charge.
And then it becomes the task of human societies, cultures, and religious communities and philosophers to dig deep and find out what that message is that's beyond just what science is telling us.